Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Indigo Field by Marjorie Hudson, narrated by Allison Johnson. So the candle flickers and goes out. We have a piece of flint and a spark. Stop the words now. Open the window in the center of your chest and let the spirits fly in and out. Rumi. They that sow the wind shall reap the whirlwind. The Book of Hosea. Part 1. Abandoned Field. 1. Tucked between the Cedar River and the monstrous pines of the Gooley Ridge lies an ancient field, tangled and wild, knee-high with last year's scrub, strewn with rocks the size of crouching men and sleeping deer. Its soil is deep and loamy. It has been planted but never plowed. It is spring, and up on the ridge a breeze lifts the broad crowns of the Gooley pines, releasing yellow clouds of pollen that float across the highway and come to rest on every flat surface of Stonehaven Downs Retirement Village, including the hood of Colonel Randolph Jefferson Lee's new Honda Accord. West of the ridge, across Spill Creek, the breeze raises wild bees from the hollow heart of Miss Reba Sycamore. The bees rise up from that dark cove of sweetness, hover over three strange cedar statues in the yard, then head across the creek and through the woods. They pause over Jolene Blake's tidy fields, then glimmer up the Gooley Ridge and gather among the old pines, humming. The pine boughs flicker with the wings of small birds in mating plumage, goldfinches and cardinals, bluebirds and jays, and a lonely painted bunting blown here from the coast in a wild storm. The Gooley pines have lived through drought and flood. They know the glaze of ice and the glimmer of sun on their cracked cupped bark, each scale like a small ear alert for sound. The giant trunks sense the movement of vast oceans. They taste the breeze and know a storm will rise along the coast of Africa. They listen to the stories of the field. The human stories they hold happened 100 years ago, or just yesterday, or maybe 10 years hence. It makes no difference to the Ghoulies, for time is eternal and flowing, caught in circles within circles, uncounted. Colonel Randolph Jefferson Lee, retired Army, prepares for his daily run, which he's lied about for months, telling Anne he will stay in the neighborhood, he will call her on the cell if he gets in trouble, and he will keep it down to a stroll, a slow walk, no running. Rand glances guiltily at Anne sitting at the kitchen table, her fluffy, just-washed white blonde hair, her head tilted in that funny way of hers, peering through her fancy multicolor reading glasses at the paper. The lovebirds chatter in their cage next to the window. Anne's deep into her morning routine. Looking out the window now, with pursed lips, something on her mind. He wonders sometimes if she thinks about Malaysia, their last posting, and all that happened there. But now she turns to the lovebirds in their cage, lifts the latch, and that mischievous grin, that morning joy, is back. God, she's a beauty. How did he ever catch a woman like her? By pretending to be a man who belonged in a place like this. He slurps coffee, steals another look. Is she snubbing him after their dust-up last night? She asked him to come with her today to some crazy spring gala where all the ladies are supposed to wear sundresses and the men are supposed to wear straw hats. Croquet is involved, she said, or cricket, she wasn't sure which, and vodka-spiked lemonade, and it is all supposed to celebrate the first day of the Stonehaven Farmers Market. What does farming have to do with croquet? He'd asked her. It's the dumbest thing I ever heard.
Don't be such a spoilsport, she said. I think it'll be fun.
The social program here seems modeled after a summer camp for southern debutantes. Tea and crumpets, balls and juleps. My God, last April, when they were still new here, before he'd figured out their game, they'd bust the newcomers down to some coastal plantation for a party with hoop skirts and a Rhett Butler look-alike. Rand stood cringing in a corner, getting drunk as fast as possible. Anne ate it up, laughing, asking to see elaborate pantaloons under those skirts, even dancing with the Rhett character, who was paunchy and 40-ish up close, and from what Rand could tell, knew only one dance step.
The man led Anne in an endless backward circle till they were both dizzy and had to sit down. Rand avoided dancing, but he remembers a ridiculous twinge of jealousy about that Rhett character spending so much time holding his wife. Anne seemed to be enjoying that a bit much. To be fair, she had agreed later that having the black serving staff sing Dixie for them had been in terrible taste.
"Maybe they were being ironic," she said with her wry grin. "God, I hope so."
Since then, Rand has picked and chosen his social events carefully. These days, Anne goes to most of them alone, or with her new friends Bess and George. Rand finishes his ration of half a cup of black coffee, turns to the kitchen window where he can just see the crowns of the gooly pines across the highway, lit by the early slanting light. Strange gurgling sounds emerge from his gut. He ignores them, glugs bottled water at the counter, stretches his calves, aware that his once taut body is not taking punishment well these days, not well at all. Anne comes up behind him, rests her fingertips on his biceps, and peers out the window over his shoulder, her small breasts brushing against his back. All is forgiven. Her hair tickles his neck. It smells faintly sugary, like strawberries, with a sharper scent underneath, some lemony new perfume. He feels a stirring in his groin, which quickly fades. Old soldiers never die, they just get soft.
"Look at that light," she exclaims. "It's positively..."
She searches for the right word.
"Roman," she decides. "That lovely slant and glimmer. Well, I guess Michelangelo could have painted those trees. They're old enough. What a painting he would have made."
He agrees, but what he says is,
"I don't think he made it here in his travels, dear. And if he had, the ones you see now would have been knee-high."
He hears the sharp tone in his voice, a crabbiness that has seeped into his daily intercourse with Anne more and more, but he can't help it. The more she bubbles about this place, this county, its inhabitants, the more it annoys him. He feels Anne's fingertips withdraw and smells her faint coffee breath as she turns away. A chill descends between them like a thin glass panel.
"I'm just remembering Rome," she says a little sadly.
"Ah, Roma," he says, softening. They had both been entranced by Rome.
He's the one who'd made sure they flew via Rome and paused a few days there whenever they had home leave in their early days. That was a long time ago. Since then, they'd raised kids, moved stateside, sold the house on Long Island, and just a year ago retired south, to this place that Anne loves and he, after giving it chance after chance, truly despises. He agreed to come only because, after all their foreign postings, it was time she got to decide where they would live. It is a pretty world, but he sees through it. Yankee duffers perfecting their golf game, as if a low score will ward off death. Wives planting petunias as if their lives depended on it. Only the running is keeping him sane. That and coming up with new ways to avoid Anne's nutty social plans. Now she's opened the birdcage, has one of the lovebirds in her hand, stroking it, humming a little song, peering at it over her glasses while it pecks seed from her palm. Anne keeps lovebirds in the breakfast nook and a pair of cockatiels in the den, presents to him for some anniversary or another over the years. They've had them for ages. She's fond of them. She feeds them and cares for them, but she claims they're really for him.
"Let's face it," she always says, "you're a bird fanatic."
"True," he always says, "wild birds." Not these caged, muttering creatures. He can barely look at them. It seems to him what they want is out.
He lets the cockatiels out sometimes when she's not around, lets them walk up his outstretched arms and peck his hair, lets them fly around the room, like a damn kid being bad. He always wipes off the furniture as needed before she gets back, and she's never said a word about it, although by glances and lifted eyebrows, he knows she knows. Their first days here, she tried to convert him into one of those doddering birders who travel in a pack, doing their Christmas counts and Audubon surveys. He tried that once or twice and hated it. Now he's the one who heads out alone and spies on birds,
part of his walking therapy, and she tromps out with a cast of thousands, scaring them all off. "You make everything into a party," he said to her, complaining.
"And you pick the solitary sports," she'd said. "Running, for instance."
That was not true, of course. He ran with Kip Larson for most of last year and enjoyed the company thoroughly. She was always a people person, but now she's such a social butterfly he finds it unsettling and a little lonely, as if he's suddenly bunking with an unpredictable younger woman. She catches him looking.
"Going for your walk, dear?" she says.
"Right."
"I'm off to tennis."
So, she is skipping the spring gala after all. Good. The cutest farmer's market in the world can start without them. "Okay." Rand pulls his ball cap over his bristly military cut.
"Be safe," she calls after him. "And listen to the birds."
"I will," he says. Anne's lips curl in the slightest of wry grins from behind her coffee mug. Forgiven again. He leans in to kiss her goodbye, an old habit that still suffices to warm him.
"Lipstick," she says.
She turns her head slightly. He gives her a peck on the cheek. That cheek his whole life has been soft, powdered and gardenia-scented, like a kept woman's, behind the compound walls of overseas military housing. Now it is lean and brown and salty like a tomboy's, playing all that tennis through the mild winter. Rand opens the door, steps outside, and lets the fine April day enter his lungs. It is, after all, the one beautiful time of year around here. He might see that pileated woodpecker find its roost. He looks up, sees the pines glowing on the hill across the highway like a promise, and sets off walking down the asphalt path, watching his feet, one of which drags a little when he tries to go faster. By the time Rand turns down Sir Walter Raleigh Way, his Achilles tendon is tight as a drum, and his left knee starts to catch and make that clicking sound. He speeds it up, starts run-walking, pumping his arms, letting his hips slide side to side in that peculiar-looking way. It gets the heart rate up, but none of Anne's spies will mistake it for running. He slips his hand surreptitiously into his pocket, turns off his phone. There are many spots in this new neighborhood where coverage fades out. That's what he tells Anne, anyway. He hates the feeling of something alive and demanding on his person, tracking his every move. He doesn't like the hard bounce of it in his pocket, either, and he's thought about losing it in a pile of pine straw in the woods, but she would just get him another. Besides, it's part of the plan. Their first year here, he simply pretended it wasn't happening again. All the signs floating below consciousness like some watery checklist for drowning. Shortness of breath, the lead weight in his legs when he tried to run, worse every morning instead of better. Finally, the sweating collapse 6 months ago on the pale blue living room carpet, shooting pains traveling into his jaw, nothing to do but stare up at the carved roses in the underside of the dining room table, at his gun collection display cabinet on the wall. His only contribution to Anne's new decor. Below it, Decker's chestnut table that Anne insisted be displayed in a prominent location. He lay there, clenching his jaw and trying to breathe.
Anne was lunching with her new friend Bess.
He'd managed to call 911 himself, crush some aspirin between his molars and hang on. The EMTs arrived in due time and took him to the hospital, where they reamed out his arteries, put him on cholesterol drugs. "This isn't ordinary heart trouble," the Quarryville doctors told him. "You have a hole in your heart. Strange it was never diagnosed." That's what had made it hard to run up a hill since he was a young boy. He had few symptoms, and he's already lived longer than was reasonable. He could go at any time. He let Anne think it was one of those other heart conditions. No need to scare her. So he runs. He'll either get better or he'll die trying. Meanwhile, he is getting his papers in order, checking off the tasks. Will signed and notarized, stock portfolio rebalanced, pension papers in files, life insurance on auto pay. After he's gone, she'll finally know. He did it all for her. And he won't have to watch anymore as Anne falls in love,
blatantly, besottedly in love with Stonehaven Downs. She is in love with the commons, gated and picketed to keep in some rare and exceptionally cute form of sheep cropping away as tourists snap photos. She is in love with the expensive little shops in the village square, the Ladies for Lunch Cafe, the cappuccino wagon, the first, no doubt, in this dusty, hazy, forgotten scrap of the rural South, and one that attracts more flies than clientele on August afternoons. She is in love with the little town of Quarryville, the tiny Episcopal church, the quirky health food store, the farm supply place with its baby chicks, and all those places she volunteers. He's lost track, there are so many.
"Rand, you should come exploring with me someday," she used to say.
"Gotta work on some paperwork," he always said. On their brief visit to the new house last Christmas, the kids, Carrie and Jeff, who never used to agree on anything, looked around, looked at each other, and gave their approval to the move. Carrie, squinting through her fashionable L.A. Catwoman glasses at the new decor, the sheep, the neighbors, saw the sense of the move. Jeff, sitting unshaven at the kitchen table, in a ripped sweatshirt from the University of New Mexico Archaeology Department, dicing celery for the stuffing, saw that his mother was happy. Still, neither one of them could figure out why anyone would want to live in the South.
"It's weird here," Carrie said, twirling her wispy hair around a pencil. "I mean, at the gas station, these guys were picking the filters off their Winstons and smoking up the room. I mean, isn't that against the law here like it is every place else? Talking about NASCAR and chewing on Slim Jims. It's like that old show on Nickelodeon where the sheriff goes fishing with Opie."
"Andy Griffith," Jeff said.
He lined his celery up and eased the blade through the ribs in straight lines, then made careful cuts crosswise.
"Yeah, it's like that. A time warp. 1950s Southern cracker land."
"The South will rise again," Jeff says, his lip curled in a half-grin, half-challenge. "Isn't that what they say?"
"This isn't the South," Rand told them. "I'm from the South. This is Stonehaven Downs, a world unto itself."
Anne gave him a look.
"We love it here," she said, turning to smile brightly at the kids. "It's perfect."
Rand turns down Queen of Scots Way. Now he remembers. No wonder Anne was so happy this morning, humming her little tune. He finally gave in last night and promised her a dinner party for 12. She will at long last get to use her mother's ancient dining room table with matching chairs in English oak and chintz. The story goes that table was Tudor, stolen from a pirate ship and dragged to the New World by some colonizing ancestor. No doubt there will be ornate silver settings with her family crest and individual crystal salt bowls with tiny individual salt spoons. She's been wanting to use those ever since she got here.
"Help me add a leaf tomorrow," she said.
"It's not for weeks," he said. "Why do it now?"
"I want to practice place settings."
"Oh, for Christ's sake."
His usefulness to society these days seemed to be limited to changing light bulbs, putting out the trash, and moving furniture.
"Rand, you're going to enjoy this if it kills me. It's going to be a strawberry dinner. Standing rib roast, strawberry shortcake, all your favorites. Bess said the farmer's market will have them then, first of the season."
"I'll enjoy the meat," he grumped. "But please, by all that's holy, don't put strawberries in the wine."
"Oh, why not? You don't drink wine anyway."
He has not yet figured out a way to get out of it. Dinner with six self-satisfied retired Connecticut couples, all strangers, is his idea of hell. The inane chatter, the sloppy drinking, the inevitable social climbing and one-upmanship. Civilians are just as bad as mid-rank military. They like to brag while pretending not to. Here they brag about their kids and grandkids, their furniture and collections, their former lives, their travels. She can do that kind of thing without him soon enough. Rand crosses Lady Jane Grey Way, breath coming ragged now. He passes a gaggle of garden ladies, all done up in grass hats and latex-dipped gloves, planting petunias out early before the heat of the day. They wave. He nods, knowing they'll report any sign of weakness to Anne. He knows he looks more fit than their husbands, which makes him suck in his gut, which throws off his stride, and before he can catch himself, he trips on a chunk of asphalt. The new roads in this place are already dissolving. Twists his knee, stumbles, bounces off the heel of one hand, and recovers. The ladies call out,
"Oh, Colonel! Are you okay, Colonel?"
They are coming this way. Crap. A new hot nerve shoots pain from knee to ankle. He waves the ladies away, keeps going, waits till they are out of view to stop and pick the asphalt out of his palm.
"Have a good run, Colonel."
Another one of Anne's friends, picking up her paper from the driveway. He waves half-heartedly. This is one of Anne's spies. After the heart attack, all her new cronies took Anne aside and instructed her on how to manage a bearish retired husband with heart trouble. It was just after Kip Larson went to the hospital, and the Stonehaven ladies were on high alert. One day when he breezed into the kitchen, having experimented with a new route home, he found her on the phone looking worried, then guilty. She hung up quickly, saying, "There you are!" That happened often enough that it became clear she had some lady spies along his route, calling in reports of his progress. She gave him the phone with GPS tracking and made him promise to use it. Now, after 6 months, she's finally lost that vigilant look of wives who watch their husbands for signs of artery blockage. She's taken on a few more tennis lessons and let him go his way. For his part, when he got home from the doctor, he was terrified for the first time in his life. Not about death, old friend, but that Anne might find him when the next one came. He, who had faced off with 4-star generals and Asian dictators, couldn't stand the idea of her finding him helpless on the floor. And what would happen after? She would call 911, they would bring him back, and him, having no heart left to speak of, they'd hook him up to wires and tubes. She has read the DNR order he placed before her, but he knows she won't use it. Her heart is too soft. Hard cheek, muscled lean arms, brown legs, snapping blue eyes. She will cave the instant she sees him face down in the pale blue pile. It happened this way to Kip, who lived an underwater life of breathing machines and slow-drip feeding for months, his face floating and bloated in the blue light of his nursing home room, the whoosh of oxygen into his lungs sounding just like Darth Vader's labored breathing. Kip, the most cheerful soldier Sailor Rand had ever known. Thank God he finally died. Kip's wife Adele lost the house. She is lucky some other Stonehaven widow with more resources has taken her in. He sees her from time to time, hunted and pale, fingering the budget bin steaks at the grocery store. No, not that way for Anne. He began to make a plan to be far away from rescue when he drops. The GPS on the phone will allow her to find him before the ants find his eyes. Rand takes a furtive look around. No gardeners out in their yards, none of Anne's spies. He ducks down a dirt path between houses that leads to the highway. He crosses, heads down a side road, and looks up. The crowns of the ghouly pines blaze with light. He has timed it perfectly. If a heart attack does take him, it will take him up there, in the sharp-scented woods, birds calling overhead, cheek resting on clean pine needles. If it happens there, it will be quick. Running can be a trigger. Running uphill, well, that could finish things quite nicely. That and the sausage biscuits he's been sneaking afterward at the Sunrise Gas and Grill down the road, a pile of old tires out front, blinking lighthouse in the yard, off-brand gas, a place no self-respecting Stonehaven man ever goes, except him and Kip, he remembers with a guilty twinge. They used to sneak biscuits there. He finds the pine needle path that leads up to the enormous trees, sucks in breath for the uphill sprint. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, go. Rand is gasping for breath, forehead pressed against the bark of a behemoth pine, pulse pounding in his ears when he hears the sirens winding down Route 177 from Quarryville, faintly at first, then whooping faster and closer as it rounds the bend and crosses the Cedar River. For an instant, he thinks it's coming for him. He's imagined it so many times. He listens with dread till he hears it turn in at Stonehaven, mute its sirens, and go about its business. It is not coming up the hill to the Ghoulie Pines. He is not having a heart attack. He is not dead. Once his pulse has settled, Rand walks along the ridgetop to spy on the old white frame farmhouse below, roof painted blue. Next to it, a smart new barn with a bright tin roof. When he discovered this place last winter, it seemed abandoned. Last year's crops stubbled and burnt gray with frost, but there were signs of life. A thin stream of smoke trailed from the chimney, and sheets bellied on the clothesline like big square ghosts. He stood here catching his breath, making up a story that perhaps an old widow lady lived here, and someday she would die, or her children would decide to take her in. And then he would buy the place for a song, convince Anne to move there with him and fix it up. Abandon Stonehaven Downs and its excruciating social obligations. Rand bends to tie his shoe, hears voices. A woman in bib overalls and a red kerchief is pushing a wheeled planter along the plowed furrows below, and a big kid tamps the earth behind her with the flat of a hoe. The boy dawdles. The woman calls out,
"Bobo, keep up now."
Keep up now. His mother used to say that. Back at the home place in West Virginia, in the narrow garden patch tucked between the ridge and the creek, Ma called to him to keep up while she set seed potatoes 4 to a hill. Him, just a young boy, staring at clouds and bird migrations across a narrow slot of sky. Rand lifts his bottle, sucks down water, coughs. The boy looks up, glances his way, searching.
"Papa!"
he calls out. "Christ on toast." Rand ducks behind a tree. He looks around. Is the kid's father up here? Nobody. He waits a minute, peeks out. They've gone back to their planting. He watches a while longer, but then it starts to drizzle, and then it starts to pour, and the woman and her boy go running to the house. He turns back the way he came, sliding down the pine straw path, rain pouring off the brim of his army cap, bouncing off his shoulders. Rand jogs through the rain to the Sunrise Gas and Grill for his morning sausage biscuit and his cheap cup of coffee. At his table, he toasts an invisible kip, swallows the bitter brew, wipes his forehead and eyes with thin paper napkins. But no matter how hard he rubs, the world is still a blur outside the plate glass window. Across the highway, an ambulance comes out of the stone entrance and turns slowly toward the hospital, windshield wipers going. No siren, no big hurry.
"Another man bites the dust," Rand thinks. "Not me. Not yet."
He has to admit that he is greatly relieved. When Rand gets home, the spring shower is long over, the asphalt already dry. But their neighbor George is sitting on the kitchen stoop, head resting on crossed arms, arms around his knees. Napping? Drunk on gin and tonic, more likely, even at this hour. George is a retired attorney from Connecticut. He drinks gin and scotch interchangeably, it seems, without seeming to care which, but it's always the good stuff. None of that army issue in plastic gallon jugs. His wife Bess is Anne's best friend, her most loyal tennis partner and lunch companion. Maybe George is going to invite him to lunch again, or for a round of bad golf. He thought George had finally given up on him. He had hoped. Rand approaches, wheezing a bit, hoping his flushed face doesn't give away that he hasn't been just walking. George looks up. It is the strangest thing. His face is red and splotched. His eyes are bloodshot. His shoulders shake. There's no mistaking it. He isn't drunk. He's crying. That siren. That slow-moving ambulance.
"What happened, man?" Rand calls out, breaking into a jog. "Is it Bess?"
George shakes his head, miserable. Rand watches him try to stand, watches George's hand reach out, a trembling old man's hand. George's fingers grip his arm. His chest goes numb. There is only one other person it could be. After the first jolt, like an electric shock to the heart, Rand pushes George away, charges into the house, and shouts her name, expecting to find Anne on the floor. But she's not there. He charges back into the kitchen and demands to know where she is. George swallows his drink, sets his glass carefully on the counter.
"It was on the tennis court, old man. She just went down. She's at the hospital now. Bess is there. Buddy, there was nothing they could do. Rand grabs his phone. What hospital?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?